underneath to get good efficiency. That's a lot of hardware just for one of them. To make a phased array of those, guarantee that's a pretty elaborate arrangement there, Bob. Whereas simple wire antennas cost you very little, and there's all kinds of ways you can tune them for director, reflector, phased array, and so on. And you don't have to set them all up exactly northeast, southwest, if you know what I mean. You can put another set of wires at right angles to those, maybe a very slightly different altitude. And electronically switching, you can electronically switch directions as long as you've got enough trees on the property and enough support structures. And as I said, it's a whole area that hasn't been well investigated by the hams, and I think it should, because it can be done without big bucks and just a little bit of study and some smarts. Okay, is there anyone else who wants to sign in with a question or for the TechNet right now? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2HTV Mobile.
K1HTV.
Repeater, timeout.
K2HTV.
K1HTV, go right ahead, Rich, with your question. And by the way, when I go to your QIZ.com, what a handsome picture. Was that you a couple of years ago, Rich?
This is Dave, KA2HTV.
Sorry about that. I heard K1. Boy, am I terrible. KA2HTV, go right ahead, Dave.
Yes, but I am handsome. Question for you, Dick, but question about ground radio. Standard official answer for ground radios are, obviously, antenna is flat on the ground, you need a lot of them. Question of length, I've always questioned. Do they need to be a quarter wave length for each band that you want to use? Can it be random length if that's all you have? Or can it be a tenth of a wavelength? Most of the losses are at the beginning. And just have a lot of tenth wave radials for each band.
As I see it, Dave, a lot of tenth wave radials will give you some kind of performance. But you're not going to get 100% performance. Let me show you why. Now, let's assume that you and I set up a dipole in free space, really in free space. We're out there outside of the space shuttle. And you soon realize that if you study it enough that I can put a sheet of metal right down the middle of the dipole. In other words, at one instant of time, if I'm feeding the dipole properly, on the first half cycle, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, the left-hand side is negative, but right at the insulator in the center, there is neutrality. If at right angles to the dipole, I put an infinite sheet of metal, nothing changes. No change in the pattern, no change in the gain, no change in the impedance. And pretty soon you realize that, I only care about one hemisphere. I'm going to feed one half of the dipole with reference to that sheet of metal and throw away the other half of the dipole. Once you do that, that's a ground plane. So the infinite sheet of metal with a quarter wave of radiator, half the dipole, is the ideal ground plane. If you could fill up your backyard as a sheet of metal, it would work like a charm. As you start making the sheet of metal shorter and shorter in radial length and less of them, what starts happening is that some of the RF energy sneaks in between the wires and starts lighting up the earth. The earth is a volumetric resistive material. Even though your standing wave ratio might be pretty good, you can't tell that some of that 100 watts, that valuable 100 watts you're putting into the antenna, if 40 of those watts is going into the dirt and heating up the dirt and making the worms warmer in the wintertime and making them happy and not being radiated into space, and by conservation of energy, you're not getting it. So your ideal situation is an infinite sheet of metal. As you start making the sheet of metal shorter and shorter and skinnier pieces of wire and more gap between them, you're lighting up more and more dirt. If you've only got a small number of radios you can lay down, yes, you get the most amount of performance if each one of them is a quarter wavelength long or longer. Quarter wavelength long makes it, you get a little bit of a resonance effect, and maybe the resonance effect is not good because it's launching some signal into the ground. So if you make them all a tenth of a wavelength long, and you've only got a zillion of them, a hell of a lot of that waveform, a hell of a lot of that external magnetic field and external electronic field around your quarter wave radiator, a hell of a lot of that will be touching the dirt if your ground plane radials are only a tenth of a wavelength long. Therefore, you're going to be getting earth absorption. You're going to be getting loss. So the whole reason you put down the ground plane radios at all is to stop heating up the dirt. When it comes to getting an impedance match, if you only had one simple ground plane or one simple grounding rod at the center, you could readjust with your antenna tuner. Let me drop. With your antenna tuner, you could get a beautiful impedance match there, but you still would have the problem of what percentage of the power is going into that volumetric resistive material called earth in your backyard. And whether that earth is salt water or dry Mojave sand makes another huge difference, if you see where I'm going. So efficiency is the main thing you're doing it for, as I see it, Dave. KD2, HDV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And this is K2HD in the V. Don't forget, in theory that sounds great, but many of us don't have the length of the property. We have to do some compromise. Now, in effect, one can, in theory, bend the radial, but again, will that... In other words, to get that full length, you'd actually have to curve it, you know. So in theory, it's a quarter wave, but it doesn't go out the length of a quarter wave. It's just done in a circular pattern. I don't know if you can really trick the ground into thinking that you're in a quarter wave when you can't, but I mean, these are compromised situations which unfortunately require some compromise.
When I had that dipole in free space, make believe it is a kind of a bar magnet, make believe I'm laying down a piece of paper over it and I'm putting down a bunch of iron filings, and you can sort of envision the way all those iron filings would show you the external magnetic field around that bar magnet. Well, the bar magnet and the dipole has somewhat similar fields between them, the two halves of the dipole, so that now when you put that sheet of metal there and lay the whole thing down on your ground in the backyard, and you can envision those lines of force going from your ground plane radial, going from your radiator, and it's trying to go down to the mirror image above, below the earth. It's looking for the other half dipole. So those field lines are still there. They're hitting the earth, and if that earth is not covered with conductor, like a whole lot of ground plane radials or a great big sheet of copper, you're lighting up that earth and you're getting that loss. So the fact that you've zigzagged the ground plane radials and forced them into resonance is not good enough. They're not giving you the coverage of the ground where those field lines are going and they're touching the ground. If any of those field lines touch dirt, you're heating up that dirt as a dummy load. You're getting heating. And there goes your efficiency as you heat up that dirt. So this is the big problem with a quarter wave ground plane antenna. If you go to a half wave ground plane antenna and feed it from the bottom, when you're feeding a dipole, even though 99% of us think that we absolutely positively have to feed it in the center with a piece of transmission line at right angles, there's nothing magic about the center. You can feed it 10% off center, 50% off center. You can feed it at the outer edge as long as you've got the right kind of a balancing device. If I've got the wherewithal to set up a pure vertical half wave dipole radiator and feed it at the bottom, yeah, you got one step more complication. You're feeding a 1500 ohm impedance instead of a 70 ohm impedance when you feed one end. In that particular case, one particular ground rod is enough because you got those field lines going between the upper half of the dipole and the lower half of the dipole out in space. Ain't no dirt up there, if you know what I mean. You're feeding an extremely high impedance at the bottom with a darn good ground plane, with a darn good grounding rod that's got 5 ohms of resistance to the universe, to the world, if you know what I mean. And all of those field lines between the upper half and the lower half of the dipole are all a quarter wave up in the air. You feed a half wave dipole from the bottom like that without laying down all those ground plane radials, you can now get 98% efficiency, in my opinion, Dave. KA2HTV, I'll eventually get your call letters right. K2RIW in the TechNet.
But you'd have to feed it with a much higher, couldn't feed it with coax, so you'd have to use like a ladder line, which is a higher appearance of impedance in order to get the proper fit.
There's a yes and a no to that, Dave. I could feed it with ordinary coax cable going out to the base of the half-wave dipole, and there I put an LC network, a single inductor and a capacitor, an L network, near resonance as a impedance step-up device. I feed 50 ohms into it, 1500 ohms at resonance comes out of it at the junction between the inductor and the capacitor, and now I feed the antenna. So I can feed it with pure 50 ohm cable with the impedance matching device at the base of the antenna. That's one approach. I can feed it with 600 ohm open wire line and do all the impedance matching in the shack. And I guarantee there's a bunch of others, experience, other embodiments in between. There's a lot of ways you can do it. But once you realize there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center, you can feed it at the outer edge, and there are a number of antennas out there where you do feed the outer edge of a half-wave structure. A 5/8 wave ground plane really is one of these things. You just made it a little bit longer than half-wave. The ground plane, the MagMount 5/8 wave has an impedance stepping up device. It's got a pancake coil inside there, which does the impedance matching. You feed it with a 50 ohm piece of cable up to the mag mount. It steps it up to 1500 ohms and feeds your half wave or a 5/8 wave radiator on that mag mount on that automobile on your VHF frequencies. If it works that way on an automobile on VHF, guarantee you can make it work in your backyard, Dave. KA2HTV, K2RIW.
I'm sure the issue is now is the ease in which you match it. I have a beautiful X-Match tuner, for example. One of the top tuners you can get, especially if you want to run legal limit on 160. Works, and it's only warm instead of blowing up. Question is, using the ladder line is a little bit difficult in my situation. So I'm looking for something where I can just feed with 52 ohm coax right to the base of the antenna, and bingo, have it work.
I recommend you use your favorite brand of 50 ohm coax cable out to the base of the antenna. Inside of a little bit of a black box in there, you've got one inductor, one capacitor. They're both transmitting grade capacitors if you're going to run a kilowatt. That simple L network has 50 ohms input on. If you look at the schematic diagram, your transmission line feeds an inductor. The other end of the inductor feeds a capacitor. The other end of the capacitor goes to ground of the box. The junction between the inductor and the capacitor goes to the antenna. The junction between the two is 1500 ohms. The input to that L network, as I described it, is 50 ohms. You choose the right inductor, the right capacitor, make them transmitting grade. You're going to put them in a box that's about 6 inches cube, and that is the impedance match. Once you understand the theory, there's no big bucks there. There's no high technology. I know you can do that. It's unorthodox. We amateurs have no experience doing that. That doesn't mean it's not right. You simply look up L impedance matching networks, L-PAD, L networks, and whether the inductor is on top and the capacitor is on the bottom or the other way, you can make it work each way. You'd be amazed how simple that is. Choose the right inductor, the right capacitor. It's going to work like a charm. Over to you, Dave. KA2HTV, and if it doesn't work, you're going to come back and ask another question, and you're going to make it work. You got it, Dave.
You'll make it work, but you're going to be resident on one band. If you want to use 3, 4, or 5 bands, then you've got a little bit of a problem there. Anyway, I'll take that advice. When I get a chance to do it, I'll do it. Look over to you. This is K2HTV.
In that box in your backyard underneath the antenna, you've got a remotely controlled relay, and you flip in L network number 1, L network number 2, and L network number 3, depending on which band you're feeding the antenna on. Yeah, I'll admit that the antenna itself is half wave on one band and wave and a half on another band, and that the radiated pattern gets a little more complicated, but I guarantee you can do it. Or If you're willing to use ladder line, you can do all the impedance matching in the shack. I will admit that impedance matching that kind of an antenna through a piece of 50-ohm coax and doing impedance match in the shack, because a 1,500-ohm antenna on a 50-ohm piece of cable, if you did know L network matching at the base of the antenna, would be a, what, 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. That's going to make the loss of your 50-ohm coax go sky high, and it's not so desirable. So either 600-ohm line defeated or an impedance matching black box at the base of the antenna. Let us know how this turns out, Dave. It's going to be an interesting study. And for the few guys who have built half-wave vertical dipoles fed at the bottom, of the few guys in the United States who have done it, they've all said, why didn't somebody tell me that earlier? This thing works like a charm. Really, it really is a rock crusher of an antenna. Each one of them will come back and say that. And so because it is so unorthodox, so unpopular, an awful lot of us are afraid to go there. It doesn't mean it's not a darn good antenna. Okay, I'm going to go over to John next because it's time for us to pick up the Mel's Corner.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater.
KC2, WGB, K2RIW. Go right ahead, John.
KC2, WGB. Okay. All right, Dick, and good evening again. We'll take a simple one first. I have a young man who was reading about resistors. He understands capacitors and their ratings. On the resistors, he does not understand why some of them have a voltage reading. Maybe you could interpret that for him.
Yeah, I think I can. And there's two different reasons. If I had a, let me pick a number, 100-ohm resistor rated for 1 watt. 1 watt, let's make it a great big wire wound resistor. A wire-wound resistor rated for 100 watts, which means that 1 ampere of current flow through that 100-ohm resistor, I squared R is watts, or E squared over R, so 100 volts of RMS voltage on the resistor, or 1 ampere of current, would by Ohm's law and power equals E squared over R, I squared R, would equal 100 watts of dissipation. So I could put a current rating on that resistor, don't go beyond 1 ampere. I could put a voltage rating on that resistor, don't go beyond 100 volts. Or I could put a power rating on the resistor, don't go beyond 100 watts. All three of those numbers for that particular example are the same thing. That's one way of looking at it. There's another way. In the case of carbon composition resistors of high number of ohms, like 100,000 ohms, 500,000 ohms, mega ohm. They've got a nasty characteristic in that for low amounts of voltage going into that, let me pick a number, 1 mega ohm, half watt, or 1 watt RCO7 carbon composition resistor. If you really study what's going on inside of there with your microscope, you'll see there's a whole bunch of very fine carbon granules with a whole lot of air spaces between them, and they're making contact with each other in only a few spots. There's a whole lot of non-contacting air spaces between those carbon granules. And so, even though the resistor is rated half watt, if I continuously put the right amount of voltage on that resistor so that a half watt is being dissipated, and if I did it for a 1 week period of time, even with proper heat sinking of the resistor, at the end of the week I'd come back, I found out that the voltage I'm putting on there, I haven't actually calculated, but maybe something like 500 volts. The 500 volts would be arcing over some of the nearby almost contacts inside that resistor, and at the end of the week, what started off as a 1 mega ohm resistor may now be down to 100 kiloohms. The high-value carbon resistors, beyond certain voltage ratings, do some terrible things. They change resistance rather rapidly and rather large percentages. If I was using 10 mega ohm resistors that are half watt or 1 watt, I may be able to calculate that I can put, for brief periods of time, I can put half a megavolt across the resistor. Well, you try to really do that, and you're going to arc it over on the outside. So arcing over it on the outside, minor arcing on the inside, changes in the carbon composition itself. There's a whole bunch of reasons why carbon composition resistors have a maximum voltage rating where if you exceed it, you're probably going to be changing the resistor in a relatively short period of time. So these are some of the reasons I can think of a voltage rating on a resistor. So the high-value resistors are kind of delicate. And if it's a critical environment, like say, for instance, I've got a voltage divider network on the power supply of a traveling wave tube. In the case of a traveling wave tube, the exact voltage I put on the cathode, if the manufacturer tells you you've got to have 5,321 volts, and you read the data sheet carefully enough, you're going to find out that you better put that voltage in there plus or minus a couple of volts of accuracy out of 5,200. In percentage of accuracy, it's got to be real high if you want the traveling wave tube to behave correctly. And your voltage regulating power supply probably has a resistor divider network sampling that 5,321 volts, bringing it back to an operational amplifier where it's being compared against a 6-volt reference Zener diode, for instance. And so the accuracy of that voltage divider network really determines whether or not that traveling wave tube behaves correctly. And so you better really use high-quality resistors rated for high voltage. You just choose a carbon composition resistor that doesn't have a 5% accuracy rating. It's got a 20% accuracy rating, but you're carefully choosing it with your Wheatstone bridge. You know you've got exactly the right resistor you want, but you're putting a rather high voltage across it, and you think you're going to continue to get that accuracy. You'd be amazed how many people have found out the hard way that you can lose that accuracy. The power supply, you're trying to get the voltage on there to the nearest 3 volts, and you suddenly find out you're 300 volts in error, and the traveling wave tube, instead of having 30 dB of gain, has got 3 dB of gain. Instead of having 100 watts of output, has only got 3 watts of output, and you wonder what happened. From your point of view, the voltage is there, the current is there, the signal is there, and it's not happening. You'll think you lost the vacuum inside the tube. You'd be amazed how many people have run into situations like that. And there was one embarrassing situation I ran into a whole lot of years ago where the voltage accuracy of a power supply for a traveling wave tube was the hidden error that was happening, and I made the mistake of thinking something bad was happening inside the tube, like gas inside the tube, and I think it was not. So these are some of what I know about resistor ratings, voltage ratings on resistors, John. I'm pretty sure you can talk over this noise. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, can you hear me all right over that, Dick?
You're 99% there, John.
Alrighty. Dick, the only other thing he may not know about carbon-based resistors and the voltage ratings is it has a negative temperature coefficient, which when exactly what you described, when that little bit of arcing starts to elevate the temperature, you have the failure in the negative direction. So, yeah, good explanation. I'm sure he understands that now.
Yeah, even the low...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater.
Even the low-value carbon resistors are subject to change. The 120-ohm approximately resistors that were in the cathodes of the push-pull amplifier of a Heathkit oscilloscope, the push-pull output tube, those cathode resistors were supposed to be something like 120 ohms, and pretty soon they went to some other value, usually lower, and therefore the tube started running with red plates, with over-bias and so on, and the oscilloscope, the display would start going off to the top or to the bottom of the screen. So their carbon composition resistors of a low value gave a lot of grief with a lot of Heathkit oscilloscopes. And so to yank out those carbon composition resistors, which were too inexpensive for that application, and put in a higher quality wire-wound resistor of the right value was the right thing to do. 6BH7 being 12BH7, I think, was the push-pull output tube on some of those Heathkit oscilloscopes. And in the mid-60s, that was a beautiful machine, except that it had this problem, and an awful lot of them gave grief until that was corrected. Oh, with you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, just talk on top of that.
Okay, Dick, yeah, very good. All right, I'll go on to the next one. Let me let it drop. Oh, I don't have to. I have a gentleman here who has a... did he purchase? Okay, he has a spectrum analyzer. It's an older one. And he wants to know if it's okay to use an oscilloscope probe, which has a switch 1 or times 10, and it will go to 400 megahertz, his probe. He wants to know if that's okay to use on a spectrum analyzer. Will it work? It's an older spectrum analyzer. It's an early HP. He didn't give me the full free...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2RIW here. K2LDY right now on the 375 machine is telling us that each time somebody keys up out there, he loses the link. Okay, I heard the whole question. Now I'm going to repeat it, John, and that is, can you use a scope probe intended for an oscilloscope on a spectrum analyzer? The answer is absolutely yes. I've done it on many occasions. And can you use it in the times one probe mode or in the... times 10 probe mode, and the answer is absolutely yes. Works like a charm. The only catch is the calibration becomes a little bit spooky. When you're using it in the one-to-one probe mode, the signal gets coupled through to the scope probe, and amplitude is essentially unadjusted, except for the fact that the scope probe has got a little bit more inductance than a real coaxial cable connection would have. So you're going to get a little bit of a change there. When you go to the times 10 scope probe mode, as opposed to the Unity, because the scope probe has something like a 1 megohm input impedance, something like a 7 picofarad coupling capacitor inside, and it's intended to feed the scope front panel connector at something like a 1,000 ohm impedance, you get a bunch of impedance mismatches. That's not bad. It's just that it's a very light loading of the circuit you're touching. That's good. And the calibration becomes a little spooky. In other words, at each individual frequency, you'll have to start off with some standard length, some standard known signal, and figure out what the insertion loss is. You might find out that your times 10 scope probe, when it's picking up an RF signal at your particular frequency and coupling it into the spectrum analyzer, you might discover that it's got 23 decibels of loss. You start off with a 0 dBm signal, and the spectrum...
Repeater, timeout.
You start off with a 0 dBm signal through the times 10 probe of the scope probe, and you go into your spectrum analyzer, and the spectrum analyzer says, I see a minus 23 dBm signal, except for that calibration. And the fact that it's going to have a little bit of a slanting frequency response. The scope probe will not necessarily be flat. You'd like it to be a minus 23 dB loss in my example, and you'd like that loss to be constant from 100 megs to 1,000 megs. Well, you're going to have to calibrate it at each individual frequency. But the scope probe is a very convenient way of coupling signals into a spectrum analyzer. I've often done it, and it's convenient mechanically, and except for the insertion loss, it works like a charm. In either case, particularly when you're using the scope probe in the times one mode, you got to be very careful about one thing, and that is, as you approach an instantaneous voltage of 1 volt going into the front panel of the spectrum analyzer, when you're on the low attenuation scales, in other words, many a spectrum analyzer has a step attenuator, an RF attenuator, that sometimes you can dial in from the front panel on the older ones, and there's a bunch of relays inside which dial it in electronically inside. When you're at the 0 decibel step of the RF attenuator, and if you exceed a little bit less than 1 volt going into the center conductor of the front panel, instantaneous 1 volt, you could damage the first mixer, the doubly balanced mixer. And it's a pretty nasty replacement in some cases. So worry about the fact that, say for instance, you want to clip your scope probe in the times when mode and you've got a coupling capacitor at the end because you know you're going to check, you're going to be checking the B-plus voltage on the plate of a tube, and you're only looking for the signal, so you've got a coupling capacitor.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So you've got a coupling capacitor to make sure that the 100 volts on the plate of the tube doesn't go into your spectrum analyzer. You've got a series coupling capacitor. And now the signal that's on that plate, you want to see the way that signal looks on the spectrum analyzer. So you got that coupling capacitor. And as long as you can, by some magic, start off with that coupling capacitor properly charged, you might get away with that. But at the instant you make contact between your scope probe with that coupling capacitor into the plate of the tube, at that instant, because you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor, there'll be a very short duration spike of 100 volts being plugged into the spectrum analyzer. And anything beyond 9/10 of a volt, 1 volt, could damage that first mixer if you don't have the RF attenuator turned on to 10 or the 20 dB step of the spectrum analyzer. So other than the maximum voltage getting into the front panel of the analyzer, other than that fear, scope probes can work like a charm. Just a little bit spooky on the calibrating procedure, but I've often done it, and it's a very nice way to go probing in a circuit. As long as you make sure you're obeying right voltages in the times 10 mode, I think you're safe almost all the time. You can then move the scope probe stage by stage down the receiver and do signal tracing. Watch the signal get stronger. Watch the filtering take place as you tap into the receiver into various places and look on that spectrum analyzer screen. As a signal tracing function with that scope probe, that can be a lot of fun. KC2 WGB. Go on to the next one if you want to, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Excellent. I think you'll have a lot of fun with that. I've done it myself. You know, a couple of rules to follow when you're using a voltmeter. Same thing with the spectrum analyzers. You start at a high range, just like you would on a voltmeter, so that you don't make the mistake of overpowering the circuit. That's always a good guideline to go by. And he could make himself up a little frequency chart, and I think he would be able to follow signals, because as he transitions down the strip, the gain will give him a representation which is completely normal, and he will be able to see the gain or not see it. So I think that would work fine for him. Let me let it drop.
I'm going to give you one more danger on this one, though, John. Let's assume now that the signal you're looking for, the AC signal on the plate of the tube, is a very small signal. It's the first RF amplifier, and the plate's got 100 volts on it, and you've got a coupling capacitor in there, and so you started off with a very high attenuation setting, a very low sensitivity setting of the spectrum analyzer, and with a coupling capacitor, you attached your probe to the plate of the tube, so that the 100 volts now charge that capacitor, and so now the voltage getting into the scope probe connector at the panel of the analyzer is going back down to 0 volts, and you can now turn to the lower attenuation setting on the analyzer where you're getting greater sensitivity, and you're looking for that very weak signal. That's good. However, if in the process you make the mistake of touching ground with that scope probe, now the capacitor that has been charged to 100 volts suddenly gets a grounded connection, and now the 100 volts get shoved into the spectrum analyzer, even though you're going away from the tube, if you know what I mean. So any drastic change of voltage with a coupling capacitor setting, when you're in the more sensitive mode of the spectrum analyzer, you've got to worry about either polarity of voltage exceeding 1 volt going into that front panel when the analyzer is set in the sensitive mode. KC2 WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Another excellent point, Dick. That is true. Yeah, and that's happened.
9:25 p.m. 9:25 p.m. Welcome to the W2. 9:26 p.m.
I do law token at all.
Okay. I heard you on the input, John, but I didn't hear you on the output. You weren't coming through the machine. And because I was flipping so many things, I wasn't paying enough attention to what you're telling me about now, about the way you're feeding an antenna. So repeat the question, John. Go ahead. Okay. I've got the dipole being fed with an isolation transformer. And by the way, I'm repeating what you're saying because you're not coming through the machine, and I am. And I think you know why. You might want to make that change. So you've got a dipole antenna being fed with an impedance matching transformer or a Balun-like device. Go right ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I'll hear you on the input there, John, so don't worry.
John, come up to UHF for a second.
Okay, question. Okay, so the original question that John asked, or the question he was asking is, he's feeding a dipole in a normal manner with the right kind of a balancing device, and now if he grounds one half of the dipole, and there's multiple ways he can do it, ground it right at the feed point, then I think he's really saying grounding it at the far point. He wants to know what happens when you do that. And let me show you step by step how we can figure out what's going to happen. You ask the average guy coming out of electrical engineering school this simple sounding question. I've got a 70 ohm dipole antenna. I've got an ordinary dipole, half wavelength long, impedance at the center is 70 ohms. I'm feeding it with 70 ohm twin lead. And I've got a 70 ohm balancing device at the shack. So I've got 1 watt. Let's assume I got 2 volts of signal coming out of the transmitter going into the 70 ohm twin lead. So the signal is 2 volt signal, RMS, is going down the twin lead, and it feeds the 70 ohm dipole. All of that energy couples onto the dipole, and now at one instant of time, the right hand side of the dipole at the feed point is +1 volt, the left hand side of the dipole at the feed point is -1 volt, there's the 2 volts between the two. And now we're going to look at the energy going down the right hand side of the dipole. We're going to follow it. That 1 volt signal, its amount of energy, its charged energy, is traveling down that half wavelength of wire, quarter wave to the right, quarter wave to the left. It travels down that wire, hits the open circuit at the far end. The open circuit at the far end really is an open circuit. The voltage can move any way it wants to. Because it's an open circuit, because there's no more wire there, the signal sees a discontinuity, and it reflects back. Without polarity change, the signal reflects back. And it comes back to the input of the feed point, right at the center of the dipole. Because it took a quarter wavelength of time to go out to the outer tip.
Repeater, time out. Repeater.
It took a quarter wavelength of time to go out to that outer tip and reverse. It takes another quarter wavelength of time to come back. The total amount of time it takes for that signal to come back is a half wavelength in time. If it was a 1 megacycle signal, it would take a quarter microsecond to go out and a quarter microsecond to come back. You'll come back half a microsecond later. Because it's a half wavelength in time to come back, by then the signal coming out of the transmitter, being fed down the twin lead, has gone to the other phase. The +1 volt became -1 volt. You could say there's a 2 volt difference between the two. And as such, the signal bounces forward again. The bottom line of all this is that you would like to believe that the signal you launch onto a dipole crawls out of your twin lead, in my example, crawls onto the wire of the dipole, travels down that wire, and jumps into space. That's what you want to believe. Turns out that radiating or radiated an RF signal is difficult. About 5% of the signal radiates into space on the first pass. 95% of that energy is left over. It hits the end of the dipole and reflects back. The signal is going to bounce back and forth on your dipole about 20 times before it finally gets radiated into space. We call the right length selection of the dipole. Let me drop. The correct length of the dipole, we call that resonating. What that really means is the signal bouncing back and forth stays in step because there was the right length of wire, which is the right amount of time delay between those all those bounces. So all those bounces stay coherent with each other. They all stay in step, lockstep. That's what resonance is. the signal is going to bounce back and forth something like 20 times before it gets radiated in space, and you select the right electrical length to make those steps happen in phase. The easiest way to do it is to choose the right length of wire. You can choose a shorter length of wire if you choose some other method of electronic delay by putting top hat capacitors on the end of the dipole, for instance. So now, when you short one side of the dipole, that outer edge, short it to ground in this example, the signal no longer sees an open circuit. It sees a short circuit. The signal is still going to go out there and not be absorbed. It's going to bounce. But whenever a signal travels down a transmission line, a piece of wire, or whatever, if it sees a higher impedance than the right impedance, some of the signal, or all of the signal, will reflect in phase. If it sees a lower impedance, it reflects again, but slips in phase. A positive going signal becomes a negative signal when it reflects from a short circuit. So when you short circuit the outside of one half of the dipole, you've reversed the phase of the signal that comes back. Now that bouncing back and forth and the way it usually happens is not going to happen right. The first thing you're going to see with your standing wave ratio meter on your transmission line is you're going to see you suddenly got a huge standing wave ratio. It looks like you've knocked the antenna out of resonance. When you grounded one half of the dipole, you knocked it out of resonance. The bounces are not...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The bounces no longer stay in phase because you created a 180-degree phase reversal by the short circuit on one side. So you're going to get a huge impedance change. And by the way, if you short circuit the other side, you're going to get another impedance change. Neither one's going to make it come out right, by the way. With both ends of the dipole at the tip shorted, the next question is, would the dipole work at twice the frequency? And I think the answer is yes. I think the dipole would now work at twice the frequency. It would have a very high impedance in the center, but at twice the frequency, it would start working again. So as you bring your dipole near metallic objects, as the tip of the dipole starts touching the branch of a very wet tree, which is it's not a short, it's not an open, it's halfway in between. Any of these things will change the impedance that you see. You could, with the right kind of an antenna tuner, rematch and readjust and still radiate a high percentage of your power. But once you see the way the dipole really radiates, the signal's got to bounce back and forth 20 times before it finally goes into space. 5% of it on each bounce is one way of rounding things off, so to speak. It's really an exponential decay. But the dipole, if you put a very brief pulse into the dipole with the right kind of instrumentation, you could measure its rise time of the signal, you could measure its fall time or decay time, and you're really looking at the fact that the signal has to bounce 20 times before it finally gets radiated into space. That's part of the story, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet. I'm copying you beautifully on the input, but you're not coming through the machine. So whatever you say, I can repeat. So go right ahead, John. Yeah, John repeated that. He was shorting at one end of the tip of the dipole, and that was what I was addressing. Because both tips of the dipole have to have the signal seeing an open circuit reflecting back without a phase reversal. That's what happens when it sees a high impedance. Any signal that sees a high impedance reflects without phase reversal. Any signal that sees a lower impedance than the right one reflects with a phase reversal. You put a short circuit on the end of a coax cable, you're going to get a reflected signal, and right at the point of the short circuit, it's going to do a 180-degree phase reversal. A positive going signal into that point suddenly becomes a reflected negative signal. Ain't that crazy? But that's the way Mother Nature does it. So in either case, whether you short one tip or both tips, you're going to see a huge impedance change because you've disturbed the way the 20 bounces occur and the phasing of those 20 bounces. You reverse the phase on one half of the dipole of the way the bouncing happens, so you've unbalanced the antenna. It's not going to radiate anywhere near as well at that frequency unless you do a whole lot of fancy re-impedance matching. You can make it work, but that's the hard way to go. K KC2WGB. Go to the next one if you want to, John. K2RIW in the second hand.
How about now, Dick? You hear me in the output?
Hearing you beautifully in the output. Go right ahead, John.
Okay, we have time for one more. I have another one here. Got a couple today. This is a delay line question. Gentleman has a 20 microsecond delay line. And his question is, does the delay line function dependent on frequency? Is it frequency dependent, the function of the delay line? Let's see. I'll state what he's using it for. I'm assuming that this is a delay line from an old NTSC color TV.
I think there's a sort of a yes and a no to that one, John. I could design a very compact delay line where I have made a phony transmission line inside by cascading a whole great big bunch of inductors in series and capacitors and shunt. I've made a phony electronic coaxial cable by a bunch of series inductors and a bunch of shunt capacitors as a ladder network. And I can get some very nice delay out of that with proper design. But it's going to be very frequency sensitive. I could also make a delay line by really using a long piece of coax cable. However, 1 microsecond of delay, because the speed of light in air is a nanosecond per foot, 1,000 nanoseconds is 1 microsecond, and because many pieces of coax cable have got a velocity factor of, let me round it off, 70%, 1,000 feet of air would have 1,000 nanoseconds of delay, 1 microsecond of delay, because coaxial cable's got a velocity factor of 70%. 700 feet of coaxial cable would have a delay of 1 microsecond. So if I'm willing to put 20 times 700 feet of coaxial cable, wind it all up into a nice ball and put it inside this box, I could have a very broadband 20 microsecond delay line. Very few companies are going to do that. That's a lot of feet of cable, and you're going to get a lot of insertion loss. So there are ways of making a broadband delay line. I think very few of them are very broadband. I think most of them are tuned for a particular frequency. A good way of doing it is acoustically. If I take my radio signal and I put it into some kind of an electromagnetic transducer, which is twisting a piece of wire in a torsional manner. If I twist a piece of wire in a torsional manner, it really is an acoustic delay line. But across a particular brand of frequencies, I could make that work very well. And so this wind-up piece of wire being twisted in a torsional manner is a very nice delay line, and now I have another acoustic transducer at the far end to convert the mechanical action back into voltage. It's sort of a loudspeaker at one end and a microphone at the other end, so to speak, of this twisting piece of wire. Some delay lines use that technique. Other delay lines use a multiple bounce inside of a quartz crystal with a piezoelectric effect. So I've carefully designed this, let me pick a number, a 20-sided, I've got a nearly round piece of quartz, but I've made not exactly a perfect circle on the outside, I've made 20 flat sides, and I've adjusted it in such a way that the signal comes into flat surface number one, and bounces over to flat surface number 10, and then from there, it bounces over to flat surface number 2, and it works its way all the way around by bouncing back and forth. There's a kind of delay line that uses that technique. So there are various ways of doing it, but I think in general, if you've got one that's designed for, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles, if for instance it's the Collins quartz crystal filter, and it's designed for 10 megacycles, you better feed it 10 megacycles plus or minus a fraction of a megacycle. If you suddenly decide you want to use it at 35 megacycles, I think you're going to get into a lot of trouble. But I'm not a real expert on this one. I haven't used very many of them. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Now, one question I have, he should be able to do a simple test with his dual trace oscilloscope, putting one on the input and another probe on the output, and feed a signal in and be able to look at that phase delay. He should be able to see the delay exactly in milliseconds, microseconds, whatever it is. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. The best way to do that would be a dual trace oscilloscope. The upper trace has got the input and output signal directly viewed. The lower trace is the signal that goes through the delay line at the operating frequency. And now the way you set the oscilloscope, if you set it for fast sweep, you can synchronize the individual sine waves of the signal going through the delay line. If you slow down the sweep of the oscilloscope, you may not see the individual sine waves anymore, but if you now made the signal generator put in pulses and you look at the individual pulses going through, you'd more easily see the delay. If, for instance, the delay line operated at, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles and had 20 microseconds of delay, the delay would be 200 cycles of delay. See, if you set the oscilloscope so you can see one cycle, and the real delay is creating 200 cycles of delay at the operating frequency, you got a little bit of a difficulty of how you set the scope in order to prove it. Pulsing the signal would be one approach. By the way, looking at the bandwidth of your delay line with a swept signal oscillator, swept frequency network, you'd be able to sweep it and look at the change in amplitude versus frequency and find out where it's tuned if you didn't know. But what you described, the dual trace scope, and if you're real smart, you can do it with a single trace scope, but it's going to be more difficult to figure out the timing. But the dual trace scope, figuring out timing becomes quite a bit easier. But you still got this cycle ambiguity factor of setting the scope with enough resolution to see the cycles, but yet still being able to see the delay time. A little bit similar to what happens when you're viewing a radar that's got a sweeping antenna going past you. I won't go there right now. KC2WGB.
Repeater, timeout. Repeat, timeout. Cancel.
KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech band.
GB. Ah, very good, Dick. And that's why I have dual time base besides four trace scopes. Makes it a lot easier. I don't know if he has dual time base, but I know he has a dual trace. Setting the triggering, looking at that different phase delay can be a pain sometimes. But very good. And that's about it from Mel's mailbag. And glad to be here tonight. Back to you, Dick.
And to EO, I'm hearing you on the input, Rich. And until we flip the machine back to the normal operation, I may not be able to hear you through the machine. So I'll repeat everything you're saying. By the way, there is a so-called delayed sweep function that many of the better Tektronix scopes have, which properly setting it would allow you to very precisely measure what your delay line is doing. N2EL.
Trigger time into consideration.
Say what you just said again, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW, say it slowly.
Yeah, you need to take the trigger time into consideration. Even on the bad Tektronix scope, there's a minimum trigger time that you have to deal with before the delayed sweep happens.
A good point. If he's using a dual trace scope and if the delayed sweep, if the triggering delay is affecting the A sweep and the B sweep, the A picture and the B picture, then that becomes a little bit of a wash. But yes, you're right. No trigger function can trigger in a picosecond. It takes a certain length of time for the logic of the trigger function of the scope to say, aha, he's asked for a positive going slope, he's asking for 2 volts of transition around the 1 volt region, and if I see that criteria, I'm going to start the sweep. Well, there's a bunch of delay functions going on in there for the logic to say, aha, we got the right conditions, I'm going to start the sweep. N2EO, go ahead with your brief question. I'll be repeating over the air what you say because you're not coming through the machine right now. N2EO, K2RIW.
The way, Dick, you don't have that problem with dual time-based oscilloscopes, just to fill you in.
Yes, you do.
No, you don't, Eric.
You might. There's both a yes and a no there. Let's go over to EO first. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead. Yeah, that was N2EO. I'm hearing him on the input, but he's not coming through the machine. On 6 meters, Richard's getting an awful lot of noise to the west. And he thinks it's coming from Con Ed. You might have to do a little more confirming to before you bring out the heavy guns on that one, Rich. But assuming he is able to confirm that Con Ed wiring to his west is making all of this noise that's giving him grief on 6 meters, what Rich would like to know is, does anybody know the telephone number by which he can get direct access to the noise tracking people of Con Ed? Because right now he thinks he's getting quite a runaround. He's not getting the right people. He's not getting the action he wants. Now, the problem I'm going to have is that somebody who's talking back to me is strong on the input, I'll be able to hear them. If they're not strong on the input, the information that we're about to get might not get through to me or to you, Rich. So anybody with any direct telephone number that they know for Con Ed, because he has found out in the past when he tells them that it's an amateur radio interference he's getting, Con Ed doesn't seem to give him very, very good service. So he's looking for, we do have a person when it comes to LIPA. We have a LIPA person who gives you beautiful information. Is there a Con Ed equivalent that anybody knows? K2RIW and the TechNet, we're listening for anybody who's got Con Ed information.
WGB.
Go right ahead, John.
Rich, if you dial 311 and ask us specifically that number, I'm sure they'll give it to you. It's part of their complaint organization, but you can get it from 311. Also, Rich, can you give me the frequency that you notice it? Because I am to the west of you.
He did say 6 meters. Is there a specific frequency or is it broadband there, Rich? Go ahead. Rich did say it's broadband noise. He's getting it all the way across 6 meters, and with the lower amount of it, he's getting it on 2 meters, so it's really broadband. He went driving around with his automobile, and he found a place where it seems to peak up, where there is high-tension overhead lines, and he thinks that's where it's coming from. So let's hope that the 311 number will allow him to find a person that traces that interference. If it is... let me pick a number, 100 kilovolt lines that are doing it. To service those is a lot more difficult. And how long it's going to take for you to get that kind of service you're looking for, Rich, is something I worry about a little bit. If it was the distribution system going up and down the block and you had an arcing insulator, that's an easy one. If it happens to be after a distribution station and it's really coming from a 100 kilovolt line, I think I'm a little bit more worried. N2EO for any of the comments. K2RAW in the TechNet. Okay. He found a particular telephone pole where an orange wire, a grounding wire going down the pole, looks like it was a very... By the way, Bernie, K2YO, I'm hearing you on the input. If you call Eric, KE2EJ, he can give you a piece of information so that you'll come through the machine. I'm hearing on the input, but you're not coming through the machine. We'd like to hear your info. And even if you don't get a chance to do that, I'll repeat what you say. But Rich is pretty sure he's pinned it down to a particular telephone pole with sloppy wiring, where the orange wire coming down, the neutral wire coming down the pole to the ground, looks like it's very poorly connected. As he keeps coming back to that pole from any direction, that's where... the 6 meter interference on his mobile rig peaks up. K2YO, I'll hear you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
We'll be there in a second, Dick. By the way, you can go to the FCC and make for RFI complaints. You can register there and, you know, they'll whack on it.
Okay. I guess, Eric, right now we don't know of any real good ham radio contact person at Con Ed like we do at LIPA. Is that sort of what you're saying, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I used to, but that person has since been gone from Con Ed. He retired about, I guess, 8 years ago. And I've tried the number in the past, but that number's gone, so... you know, I don't know what to give you after that other than the FCC. You can go to the FCC website. There's a place to file complaints. First of all, the BPL stuff that would go on it. And by the way, they still run CPL on some of this stuff. So that may be the cause. Then again, maybe not.
K2YO.
Go right ahead, Bernie.